Welcome. This time we take up a new chapter. It's the 15th in this series called Essays on the Gita. This was published first on the 15th of October in 1917. As usual, Sri Aurobindo probably composed it a few weeks earlier. This, when it appeared in the Arya, did not have this title. It was given this title in 1923. What he called it in the Arya was The Divine Birth and Divine Works, One. There would be three parts. They've all been retitled and given much more the sense of what the thrust of the chapter is. The issue, the Arya, opened with The Life Divine as Always, and the title of that essay was From the Undivine to the Divine. After Essays on the Gita, which appeared in second place, was The Synthesis of Yoga. And its title was Conditions of the Gnosis, the Great Knowledge. So you can see how these things are each sandwiched in the other. Each thesis being set to examine the possibilities of what it means to be able to live divinely here and now, as they say in Sanskrit, ihaiva, even here. So the possibility and purpose of avatarhood in the Gita, this stands out in bold relief. We see nothing like this in Vedic hymns, in the Vedic religion. As luminous and bright as the Rigs might be in the Rig Veda, there is nothing approaching the enormity of the concepts that we see Sri Aurobindo take pains to extolling and analyzing carefully. We see, even in the Upanishads, brilliant as they are, vast as they are, nothing approaching a recognition of a personal being who is omnipresent until we approach the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, he of the white horse, the white horsed one. The Katha Upanishad, of course, has many things in common with the Gita. In fact, we'll take some time and examine some of the threads that stretch from the Katha all the way into the Bhagavad Gita. But remember, this is a few hundred years before the Common Era, BCE as we like to say now. Then we're seeing for the first time a philosophy, a vision that accepts and indeed insists upon bringing into a synthesis the mobile, evanescent, changing world along with a transcendent reality from which this must be drawn, but which itself remains immaculately timeless and spaceless, and then this larger being, whom the Gita names as the ultimate person, the supreme person, the Purushottama. And both these other orders of being, the essential, the universal, the individual, what moves in time, what expresses in sempiternal terms, what is ultimately eternal, this is the warp and the woof of the Gita's magic. It does this for the first time, and it's probably another 1500 years before we see a philosophy as similar and beautiful and resonant as what the Gita puts into place here. But the Gita hasn't rolled it out from the beginning. It's moving one phase at a time, reminding Arjuna what his work is, that his immortal spirit can't be slain, that he must go back and do the difficult thing and fight the great battle. Because the Sanatana Dharma, the holding together of the people, Loka Sangraha, demands it. And in fact, Loka Sangraha goes beyond just holding together the human peoples. We have to act in a way that holds the worlds together. We have to live in the right way, which means in the right consciousness, with behavior that conduces to that right consciousness, and in a way that sees the harmony and the oneness of all beings, of all planes of existence. So, one acts for the ants, one acts for the gods, one acts for the animal and vegetal life, one acts for oneself, one acts for all about, for family, for the divine, ultimately, one acts. Because through all of this, the divine is not absent for a moment. There is only one being, and this is what Krishna insists on introducing to Arjuna. He'll find it difficult to see and understand and accept. First, he has to know, he has to learn how to work in communion with the Supreme, offering all knowledge, all works, without demand, without expectation of fruit, so that ego subsides and he can see things as they are, without the distortion of desire, of self-interest. So here we are. Now we have to see, what is it? How is it the Supreme could come here, could be here, could be present with us? Now, the Gita wants to address this. So, the possibility and purpose of avatarhood. In speaking of this yoga, in which action and knowledge become one, the yoga of the sacrifice of works with knowledge, in which works are fulfilled in knowledge, knowledge supports, changes, and enlightens works, and both are offered to the Purushottama, the Supreme Divinity, who becomes manifest within us as Narayana, Lord of all our being and action, seated secret in our hearts forever, who becomes manifest even in the human form as the avatar, the divine birth taking possession of our humanity. Krishna has declared in passing that this was the ancient and original yoga which he gave to Vivasvan, the sun god. Vivasvan gave it to Manu, the father of men. Manu gave it to Ikshvaku, head of the solar line. And so it came down from royal sage to royal sage till it was lost in the great lapse of time and is now renewed for Arjuna because he is the lover and devotee, friend and comrade of the avatar. Well, there's a lot there. So we see something of the Vedic cosmology still present here in the Gita, a few thousand years after the Rig Veda was composed, we guess. He calls it the ancient and original yoga. Well, The Sanskrit is avyayam, which means imperishable. So this is a yoga that was always present. Can't go away. Yes, it's ancient. It's also new. This original teaching was given by the divine to Vivasvan. So there's an originating Godhead, unnamed. And then he names the sun god, Vivasvan, who might also be seen as Surya in some traditions. But we'll see him closely identified here with the god Savitra, the Lord of the Dawn, because what dispels darkness first is the resplendent rise of the sun. And in that aspect, he is Savitra. Of course, Savitri, our heroine in Sri Aurobindo's epic poem, is the daughter of the sun. And what is the sun? It's the truth. So, from an unnameable, unimaginable being, some force, some might, some power of expression comes through the Lord of the Sun to transmit into manifestation those hidden truths. And it comes through him, and it is given to the head of the human peoples, Manu, which means the thinker. So here is an unnameable reality expressing itself as an infinite solar light, now conditioning itself as the mental head of what will manifest upon Earth. And then Manu gives it to his son, Ikshvaku, who's the head of the solar line. So this whole thread, which leads from above, from the transcendent, in here into the universal manifestation, is a continuum of truth. And as it comes to the solar line, it goes on and on and on, from Raja Rishaya, from royal sage to royal sage. Note this, because not everywhere in the Veda is the emphasis given to the king who knows. But this is a great tradition and becomes more and more powerful in India. Look, who is the hero of this? If it's Arjuna or if it's Krishna, it's still a king. It's a Raja, not a renunciant, not a priest. It is someone actively engaged in life who is filled with spiritual light and power, who is undertaking the work of maintaining and carrying forward the cosmos. Huh. Till it was lost in the great lapse of time and is now renewed, or the Sanskrit says proktaha, so means it was taught. It is being taught again as a renewed teaching, as it must be from age to age. Eternity speaks to time continuously according to the circumstances of time. But always the voice is the eternals that we hear. Because Arjuna is the lover and devotee, he's a bhakta, which means he has attached himself to Krishna as a friend, but also as a soul to the great soul. It is this attachment, it's not merely love, it's wanting to be near in terms of knowledge, in terms of love, in terms of dynamizing what one gets. That is the essence, the identity between the aspirant and that to which we aspire. Friend, comrade of the avatar. The term means one who descends. In a sense, as Sri Aurobindo will make the point, we are all avatars. And we were saying this just a couple of weeks ago, weren't we, together? That one of the secrets of our work in the cosmos is that we're not thrown here or cast out of heaven, and here we came falling down somewhere into this abysmal globe. We chose to come here. We have descended of a purpose. We have come here to join the labor that will return the darkness to light without sacrificing all the formal elements that exist when we arrive. So that's the redemption that the soul promises to deliver as it descends into the earth. And who leads the way? The Supreme Person, to show us how it is done so that we can fashion our tailor-made clothes to fit similarly, so that we are like that. For this, he says, is the highest secret, rahasyam uttamam. Thus, claiming for it a superiority to all other forms of yoga, because those others lead to the impersonal Brahman, or to a personal deity, to a liberation in actionless knowledge, or a liberation in absorbed beatitude. But this gives the highest secret and the whole secret. It brings us to divine peace and divine works, to divine knowledge, action, and ecstasy, unified in a perfect freedom. It unites into itself all the yogic paths as the highest being of the divine reconciles and makes one in itself all the different and even contrary powers and principles of its manifested being. Therefore, this yoga of the Gita is not, as some contend, only the karma yoga, one and the lowest according to them of the three paths, but a highest yoga, synthetic and integral, directing Godward all the powers of our being. This is adumbrated in the Mandukya Upanishad, in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, but it is here in the Gita that we hear it clearly declared. Arjuna takes the declaration about the transmission of the yoga in its most physical sense. There is another significance in which it can be taken, and asks how the sun god, one of the first born of beings, ancestor of the solar dynasty, can have received the yoga from the man, Krishna, who is only now born into the world. Krishna does not reply, as we might have expected him to have done, that it was as the divine, who is the source of all knowledge, that he gave the word to the Deva, who is his form of knowledge, giver of all inner and outer light, Bhargaha Savitur Devasya Yono Dhiya Prachodayat. He accepts instead the opportunity which Arjuna gives him of declaring his concealed Godhead, a declaration for which he had prepared when he gave himself as the divine example for the worker who is not bound by his works, but which he has not yet quite explicitly made. He now openly announces himself as the incarnate Godhead, the Avatar. By the way, this is a close paraphrase. What Sri Aurobindo has placed here in Sanskrit might have occurred to him as inspiration. It's very near what we all know as the Gayatri, Rigveda 3, hymn 62. In English, the power and light of Savitri, which should impel our thoughts. In other words, being open to the truth, let our thoughts be guided. Tat savitur varinyam bargo devasya dhimahi dio yonaha prachodayat. That's the original Savitri, the Gayatri. So, when he says there is another significance in which it can be taken, we've hinted at it already, that it is the transmission of the eternal conscious being through the manifestation of the Sun God, what we would call the supramental, into the mental realm, captured by Manu as well as he can, and then sustaining humanity with it. That could be what Arjuna wants to know. But instead, he asks the physical question. That was then and this is now. How did that get here? It leads to an open declaration by Krishna that he is himself the Purushottama, the Avatar. We have had occasion already, writes Sri Aurobindo, when speaking of the divine teacher, to state briefly the doctrine of avatarhood as it appears to us in the light of Vedanta, the light in which the Gita presents it to us. We must now look a little more closely at this avatarhood and at the significance of the divine birth, of which it is the outward expression. For that is a link of considerable importance in the integral teaching of the Gita. And we may first translate the words of the teacher himself, in which the nature and purpose of avatarhood are given summarily, and remind ourselves also of other passages or references which bear upon it. So now this little section coming up is chapter 4, shlokas 5 through 11. Many are my lives that are past, and thine also, O Arjuna. All of them I know, but thou knowest not, O scourge of the foe. Though I am the unborn, though I am imperishable in my self-existence, though I am the Lord of all existences, yet I stand upon my own nature, and I come into birth by myself, Maya. For whensoever there is the fading of the Dharma and the uprising of unrighteousness, then I loose myself forth into birth. For the deliverance of the good, for the destruction of the evildoers, for the enthroning of the right, I am born from age to age. He who knoweth thus in its right principles my divine birth and my divine work, when he abandons his body, comes not to rebirth, he comes to me, O Arjuna. Delivered from liking and fear and wrath, full of me, taking refuge in me. Many, purified by austerity of knowledge, have arrived at my nature of being, Madbhavam, the divine nature of the Purushottama. As men approach me, so I accept them to my love, Bhajami. Men, follow in every way my path, O son of Pritha. Note also in what Sri Aurobindo translated here, we have something close to the original use of the term Maya. Maya is not a cunning force that deceives and bewilders and confuses. It is a power of the divine conscious being to convert its infinity into the finite, to condense the vastness of what it is into a singular and significant form, be that a cosmos, be that an individual soul. He says, though I am unborn, I stand upon my own nature, and I come into birth by myself, Maya. Now, what we'll see him do is suggest that every soul has within them this power. How else could you be here? Do you think you're an unwitting slave? You are a conscious collaborator and participant in this. You are not driven. You are not gulled into being here in the cosmos. By golly, you have accepted the mission. You signed up. Sri Aurobindo continues. But most men, the Gita goes on to say, desiring the fulfillment of their works, sacrifice to the gods, to various forms and personalities of the one Godhead. Because the fulfillment, siddhi, that is born of works without knowledge, is very swift and easy in the human world. It belongs indeed to that world alone. And note that here we're in chapter 4 still and running from shlokas 12 through 15. So we come here and we're blinkered a bit and we're blinded a bit by our sudden immersion into a confusing world. We haven't found the secret of our souls yet. And so we do notice that there are gods abundant in the cosmos. And so we engage in communion with them. We offer this, we get that. And those are the kind of easy, swift victories which pull us out of the mire. At least we become conscious of something above, but it's not of the highest. Sri Aurobindo continues, it belongs indeed to that world alone. And these would be like the Vedic rituals, like the Vedic sacrifices. Krishna has had enough of that. He wants to call Arjuna and following humanity to a higher standard. The other, the divine self-fulfillment in man by the sacrifice with knowledge to the Supreme Godhead, is much more difficult. Its results belong to a higher plane of existence, and they are less easily grasped. Men therefore have to follow the fourfold law of their nature and works, and on this plane of mundane action, they seek the Godhead through his various qualities. He's talking here about the fourfold order of existence. Chaturvanyam, the four colors. Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra. That's not necessarily putting things down, by the way, because you can see how these ally themselves to the four states of the Divine Mother, the four aspects, the four powers that we know so well. Knowledge, Maheshwari. Power, Mahakali. Beauty and prosperity, Mahalakshmi. Perfection in work, carrying things out to the last detail, Mahasaraswati. But, says Krishna, though I am the doer of the fourfold works and creator of its fourfold law, yet I must be known also as the non-doer, the imperishable, the immutable self. So here we're moving again from the Kshara Purusha to the Akshara Purusha. Quote, works affect me not, nor have I desire for the fruit of works, for God is the impersonal beyond this egoistic personality and this strife of the modes of nature. And as the Purushottama also, the impersonal personality, he possesses this supreme freedom even in works. And again, the figure of Nataraja, a few hundred years later, captures it in bronze perfectly. Doing all the works in the world, sustaining the cosmos, saving those who approach, but eyes always withdrawn. Maybe standing, maybe dancing, but always seated in peace and bliss. Nataraj has not lost himself in the violence of the dance. He remains the infinite always he was, and is a beacon reminding us that we can be that. Therefore, the doer of divine works, even while following the fourfold law, has to know and live in that which is beyond, in the impersonal self, and so in the supreme Godhead. He who thus knows me is not bound by his works. So knowing was work done by the men of old who sought liberation. Do therefore thou also work of that more ancient kind, done by ancient men. So, 4:15. The second portion of these passages, which has here been given in substance, explains the nature of divine works, divyam karma, with the principle of which we have had to deal in the last essay. The first, which has been fully translated, explains the way of the divine birth, divyam janma, the avatarhood. 4:9, by the way. But we have to remark carefully that the upholding of dharma in the world is not the only object of the descent of the avatar. That great mystery of the divine manifest in humanity. For the upholding of the dharma is not an all-sufficient object in itself, not the supreme possible aim for the manifestation of a Christ, a Krishna, a Buddha, but is only the general condition of a higher aim and a more supreme and divine utility. For there are two aspects of the divine birth. One is a descent, the birth of God in humanity, the Godhead manifesting itself in the human form and nature, the eternal avatar. The other is an ascent, the birth of man into the Godhead, man rising into the divine nature and consciousness, madbhavam agataha. It is the being born anew in a second birth of the soul. 4:10. It is that new birth which avatarhood and the upholding of the Dharma are intended to serve. This double aspect in the Gita's doctrine of avatarhood is apt to be missed by the cursory reader, satisfied as most are, with catching a superficial view of its profound teachings, and it is missed too by the formal commentator, petrified in the rigidity of the schools. Remember, the Gita is before all these schools. It is afterwards that we get commentaries from Advaita and Vishishtadvaita and Dvaita. Those all follow lengthily in the wake of the teaching of the Bhagavad Gita. Yet it is necessary, surely, to the whole meaning of the doctrine. Otherwise, the avatar idea would be only a dogma, a popular superstition, or an imaginative or mystic deification of historical or legendary supermen, not what the Gita makes all its teaching, a deep philosophical and religious truth, and an essential part of, or step to, the supreme mystery of all. Rahasyam Uttamam. 4:3. So he'll argue later that if the purpose of the avatar was simply to come and put down darkness and restore light, maintain the Sanatana Dharma, this is an omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent being. He doesn't have to come here to do that. He can achieve this through his vibhutis, through the open vessels in humanity, those who are receptive. No, it's something else. Sri Aurobindo is suggesting that he comes to act as an exemplar, to cut a pathway, to show how we lift our consciousness into new realms, become greater than attained humanity, take a step beyond. Clearly, we see this is what Sri Aurobindo intends to do in the Integral Yoga, but he suggests that this also is part of Krishna's purpose on the battlefield at Kurukshetra, to introduce a new range of conscious possibilities to humanity, first through Arjuna and then through others who are receptive. So, if there were not this rising of man into the Godhead to be helped by the descent of God into humanity, avatarhood, for the sake of the Dharma, would be an osho's phenomenon, since mere right, mere justice, or standards of virtue can always be upheld by the divine omnipotence through its ordinary means, by great men or great movements, by the life and work of sages and kings and religious teachers without any actual incarnation. Osho's, one of the beautiful words Sri Aurobindo commands from his days in Oxford, which means functionless and unoccupied in leisure. The avatar comes as the manifestation of the divine nature in the human nature. The apocalypse, the appearance, the apocalypse of its Christhood, Krishnahood, Buddhahood, in order that the human nature may, by molding its principle, thought, feeling, action, being on the lines of that Christhood, Krishnahood, Buddhahood, transfigure itself into the divine. The law, the Dharma, which the avatar establishes, is given for that purpose chiefly. The Christ, Krishna, Buddha, stands in its center as the gate. He makes through himself the way men shall follow. That is why each incarnation holds before men his own example and declares of himself that he is the way and the gate. He declares, too, the oneness of his humanity with the divine being, declares that the Son of Man and the Father above from whom he has descended are one, that Krishna in the human body, Manushim Tanum Ashritam, and the Supreme Lord and Friend of all creatures are but two revelations of the same divine Purushottama, revealed there in his own being, revealed here in the type of humanity. That quotation is from chapter 9, shloka 11. Manushim tanum ashritam. That the Gita contains as its kernel this second and real object of the avatarhood is evident even from this passage by itself rightly considered. But it becomes much clearer if we take it not by itself, always the wrong way to deal with the text of the Gita, but in its right close connection with other passages and with the whole teaching. In other words, you have to see all the Gita at once to understand the part. You have to see the whole to get the part. We have to remember and take together its doctrine of the one self and all, of the Godhead seated in the heart of every creature, its teaching about the relations between the Creator and his creation, its strongly emphasized idea of the Vibhuti, noting too the language in which the teacher gives his own divine example of selfless works, which applies equally to the human Krishna and the divine Lord of the worlds, and giving their due weight to such passages as that in the 9th chapter. Deluded minds despise me, lodged in the human body, because they know not my supreme nature of being, Lord of all existences. And we have to read in the light of these ideas this passage we find before us, and its declaration that by the knowledge of his divine birth and divine works, men come to the divine, and by becoming full of him, and even as he, and taking refuge in him, they arrive at his nature and status of being, Madbhavam. So, deluded minds, that passage, again, that's 9:11. The passage we just ended with Madbhavam, that's chapter 4, 9 and 10. And this idea that he is lodged in all human bodies ought to give pause to those of us who, gazing or glaring at a homeless individual, at someone who is presumed to be inferior in some ways, is the very mark of ignorance. For then we shall understand the divine birth and its object not as an isolated and miraculous phenomenon, but in its proper place in the whole scheme of the world manifestation. Without that, we cannot arrive at its divine mystery, but shall either scout it altogether or accept it ignorantly, and it may be superstitiously, or fall into the petty and superficial ideas of the modern mind about it, by which it loses all its inner and helpful significance. For to the modern mind, avatarhood is one of the most difficult to accept or to understand of all the ideas that are streaming in from the East upon the rationalized human consciousness. It is apt to take it, at the best, for a mere figure for some high manifestation of human power, character, genius, great work done for the world or in the world, and at the worst to regard it as a superstition. To the heathen, a foolishness, and to the Greeks, a stumbling block. The materialist, necessarily, cannot even look at it since he does not believe in God. To the rationalist or the deist, it is a folly and a thing of derision. To the thoroughgoing dualist who sees an unbridgeable gulf between the human and the divine nature, it sounds like a blasphemy. So I guess you understand all of these things. The materialist clearly doesn't believe in God, so there can be no descent of a non-existent God into humanity. A deist is a God who, or the idea of a God who creates the world and then absents himself from it, letting it just tick on like a machine that he wound up and set going but has nothing to do with it. And the dualist, well, there's no way that something as unimpeachably perfect as a supreme being would have anything to do with something as wicked and full of ordure as humanity. So, the rationalist objects that if God exists, he is extra-cosmic or supra-cosmic and does not intervene in the affairs of the world, but allows them to be governed by a fixed machinery of law. He is, in fact, a sort of far-off constitutional monarch or spiritual king log. At the best, an indifferent, inactive spirit behind the activity of nature, like some generalized or abstract witness Purusha of the Sankhyas. He is pure spirit and cannot put on a body, infinite, and cannot be finite, as the human being is finite, the ever-unborn creator, and cannot be the creature born into the world. These things are impossible even to his absolute omnipotence. Whoops, did he say omnipotence? King Log, by the way, going back to Aesop's fables, sits there and does nothing, yes? He's a log. He is the opposite of King Stork, who eats all of his frog subjects. Very active. To these objections, the thoroughgoing dualist would add that God is in his person, his role, and his nature different and separate from man. The perfect cannot put on human imperfection. The unborn personal God cannot be born as a human personality. The ruler of the worlds cannot be limited in a nature-bound human action and in a perishable human body. These objections, so formidable at first sight to the reason, seem to have been present to the mind of the teacher in the Gita when he says that although the divine is unborn, imperishable in his self-existence, the Lord of all beings, yet he assumes birth by a supreme resort to the action of his nature and by force of his self-maya. That he, whom the deluded despise because lodged in a human body, is verily in his supreme being, the Lord of all. That he is in the action of the divine consciousness, the creator of the fourfold law and the doer of the works of the world, and at the same time, in the silence of the divine consciousness, the impartial witness of the works of his own nature. For he is always, beyond both the silence and the action, the supreme Purushottama. And the Gita is able to meet all these oppositions and to reconcile all these contraries, because it starts from the Vedantic view of existence, of God and the universe. So this ranges through much of what he's translated already from the early part of chapter 4, touching on chapter 9 again, and winding up in chapter 18, shlokas 41 through 48. So this divine being, who is beyond determination, but who is and is a person, holds within itself, himself, herself, the whole vast ocean of the impersonal, manifest using the sheer existence, consciousness, and power present in that oceanic Brahman, what is here in the kshara, all that is mobile in this universe, the ordering of the planes of existence, top to bottom, from the spheres of Surya all the way to the hell of Patala, and everything in between, the fourfold order of human society, the vegetable and the animal kingdoms, all of these are instances of the Supreme Being. They are nothing else, because there can be nothing else. Only the One is. So this is the Vedantic view, as we've seen in the earliest of the Upanishads, the Brihadaranyaka, in the Isha Upanishad, Shvetashvatara Upanishad, but now voiced most clearly in the Gita. It's a teaching that will roll on and gather force and clarity as we move chapter by chapter. Right now, we're more or less in the fourth chapter and about to move on from there. Let's put a bookmark there. I've kept you a long time, but I won't let you go unless you sign off until we've read a bit from Savitri. And this is in the opening pages. Let's go to Canto 3, the Yoga of the King, the Yoga of the Soul's Release. And we'll start with the first line. The world's desire compelled her mortal birth. One in the front of the immemorial quest, protagonist of the mysterious play, in which the unknown pursues himself through forms and limits his eternity by the hours, and the blind void struggles to live and see, a thinker and toiler in the ideal's air, brought down to earth's dumb need her radiant power. His was a spirit that stooped from larger spheres into our province of ephemeral sight, a colonist from immortality, a pointing beam on earth's uncertain roads. His birth held up a symbol and a sign. His human self, like a translucent cloak, covered the all-wise who leads the unseeing world. Affiliated to cosmic space and time, and paying here God's debt to earth and man, a greater sonship was his divine right. Although consenting to mortal ignorance, his knowledge shared the light ineffable. A strength of the original permanence, entangled in the moment and its flow, he kept the vision of the vasts behind. A power was in him from the unknowable, an archivist of the symbols of the beyond, a treasurer of superhuman dreams. He bore the stamp of mighty memories and shed their grandiose ray on human life. His days were a long growth to the supreme. A skyward being nourishing its roots on sustenance from occult spiritual founts, climbed through white rays to meet an unseen sun. I think we'll pause, close for tonight, and resume this section next week when we conclude this chapter. Then I will have kept you but an hour, and you might forgive me because you have vast hearts, each of you. Thank you for your compassion. Listen, much love to you all. I look forward to seeing you again soon. Namaste. Jai Ma.